Chapter 2, The Seven Major Aspects of Self. The best way of repairing one's relationship in healing oneself. There is a well-known ancient Greek aphorism of know yourself that was interwoven throughout the philosophies of both Socrates and Plato. The Aquarian Gospel by Levi Dowling records the story of the disciples gathering around Jesus to ask questions. In this story, one disciple asked him, "What is the most important thing we should know?" To which Jesus answered, "Know yourself." The disciples, however, did not like that answer because it was not specific. So they said, "And what next should we know?" Jesus answered once again, "After you know yourselves, go back and know them some more." Knowing yourself means knowing who you are, your potential, the inherent abilities that lie within you. It also means discovering, understanding, and releasing those things that create limitation and dysfunction in your life. You cannot know yourself by looking in the mirror, or by judging yourself for having a love affair, or by looking at your portfolio of investments. To know yourself means knowing all the aspects of yourself. It means knowing all the intricate, wondrous dimensions of yourself. We judge ourselves without knowing ourselves. We judge and compare, then conclude we are failures when we have not been expressing our full abilities. We measure our abilities and our worth through our jobs, our homes, our hobbies, but really know very little about our true qualities and abilities. The seven major selves and your sexual self. So far, we've learned that the sexual self is more than physical sexual desire. The sexual self is a vibrant source of vitality and creativity. We have learned that the sexual self is affected by other aspects of ourselves, such as our male and female aspects. The sexual self is also affected by our seven major selves, those key points from which energy flows. These selves support our physical and emotional health. To fully understand our nature, our behaviors, and the influences around us, we must recognize ourselves as the multidimensional beings we are, possessing many aspects of self. Over the years, my research involved the function and expression of the major aspects of self, dissecting the whole being to find the parts that make up the whole. I began my research studying the seven major selves in the physical body. There are numerous books written about them. Most of this information and resources gives the location, color, sound, frequency, and general function associated with each self. While this was interesting, there was no material that helped me understand self and all its aspects, especially these selves as they relate to thoughts, feelings, and emotions. The selves only began to have real significance to me when I began to develop the therapy process that came to be known as Rohan. I realized that distinct personality traits, thought patterns, and feelings nearly corresponded with each self. And by working with our major selves, we can realize the amazing, creative, and inspired individuals that we all are. Each of the seven major aspects of self has a focus and energy, just as each part of your physical body has a functional purpose. The hands, the feet, the liver, the heart, the eyes, each part of the body has a function. Each part of the body is important and must function in harmony. So it is with seven aspects of self. Each aspect of self has a name that describes its focus and function. The seven major selves are the presence, the emotional self called the inner child, the achiever self, the loving self, the creative expressor, the intuitive self called the visionary, and the angel. Each of our major selves has its way of understanding and processing our experiences. It's no wonder that we experience confusion about our thoughts, feelings, and behavior, because as we go inward and examine each of our major selves, we begin to see things more clearly. Clarity is a great gift. Going within brings clarity. When given tools to understand, one can progress in ways that are important to a healthy sexual self. So, we are a complex group of selves, each of whom has its unique function and energy. Invariably, an interaction among selves was behind the mistakes we have made as well, as a catalyst for all our good deeds. To add to that complexity, the sexual self, just like all ourselves, impacts and is impacted by the seven major selves. We will learn about each major self, its purpose and function, and how each self interacts with other selves. We will start with three most familiar and most troublesome aspects of self: the presence, the emotional self, and the achiever. The three aspects of self that developed in the very early days of man's evolution. Of the seven major selves, these three are the lowest frequency and are home to the most of our dysfunctional thoughts. The presence. The self called the presence is located at the base of the spine. It is the presence that the world sees, and what you see when you look in the mirror. It's the least refined and most ancient part of ourselves. Carl Jung, the great Austrian psychologist, called this aspect of self the persona or facade. This is what we show the world. The presence reflects the accumulation of one's thoughts and feelings about self. It reflects an individual's self-image. The person with a low self-image, presence, shies away from people, often looks downward a good bit of the time, and avoids eye contact. There's a lack of vitality in the eyes. On the other hand, when the presence holds positive and healthy thoughts about self, its energy flows outward and attracts like a magnet. In such cases, needs are satisfied without a struggle. There's a popular expression, "You have to struggle to succeed," or "No pain, no gain." Life is far from a struggle when one's presence is confident, has high self-esteem, and positive thoughts and feelings. It may not always know how it will do something, but it knows it can. Those thoughts are positive, and therefore attract what the presence desires, rather than negative and resisting what it wants. Resistance attracts struggle. When someone feels confident and abundant, his or her presence exhibits higher thoughts and desires. So naturally, that someone will attract situations and people who are like higher thought and desires. One must feel abundant to attract abundance. Therein lies the importance of understanding oneself. While a distinct and separate self, the presence represents all the other aspects of self. It's one's ambassador and representative in the world. It reflects all other aspects of self into the world. Are you familiar with your presence? Are you aware of what you reflect to the world? Are you cognizant of the you that you outwardly present? Do you have a loving, confident, positive presence? An arrogant, angry, and mean presence? Shy, timid, mysterious presence? The unaware often do not understand the reactions they receive from other people. Speeding down the expressway of life with little understanding of themselves, the unaware wonder why others are not engaging them in positive ways. Blaming themselves, the unaware reinforce and strengthen the negative thoughts and feelings about self that are creating the challenges in the first place. It is easier to look outside oneself and blame others. Now, the presence reflects all yourselves. As your presence returns to full health, you will feel your beauty and youthfulness, a feeling that generates from within you. You will find that your sexual self is more vibrant, creative, and full of vitality. Sex on Saturday night, both literally and figuratively, returns. So the second emotional self is the inner child. We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when adults are afraid of the light. Plato, Greek philosophers, 400 BC. Here comes trouble. The emotional self, also called the inner child, is located just below the belly button. When healthy, the emotional self is responsible for one's vitality, youth, sensuality, and enthusiasm. Some think of this self as a troublemaker. It can be, in fact, cause many problems. In today's world, many of us stop maturing emotionally around the age of 10. At around 10, we acquire and solidify our negative thoughts and feelings about ourselves. It is also the time that we decide things like, I'm not good enough, or I'm ugly, or no one will ever love me. We develop behavior patterns, coping mechanisms, which mask any emotional pain we hold. We carry these coping mechanisms into adulthood. Perhaps we are the office clown, or keep people emotionally distant, or are hermits in our homes. The emotional self is also the place where desires are born, whether those desires are healthy or unhealthy. The emotional self wants what it wants when it wants it. It may desire something, but it does not always have the means to fully understand the consequences of acting upon that desire. In fact, it just does not care about consequences. The emotional self wants. If it does not get what it wants, just like a child, the unaware emotional self will pout, scream, jump up and down, or seek revenge. Have you ever been out in public and noticed a child throwing a tantrum to manipulate its parents to get what it wants? The unhealthy emotional self behaves in this manner. But the emotional self is powerful. Here is an example of the emotional self using the sexual self to get what it wants. Beth is an attractive woman in her early 30s. For the most part, she feels good about herself and emits an aura of beauty and contentment. Lately, however, she has been feeling lonely. It's been several years since her divorce. So Beth was hoping that she would meet someone special tonight at her party. By the time she arrives, the party is well underway. Everyone is eating, drinking, and socializing. Beth gets a drink and begins to mingle. Suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, she spots the most attractive man, a man with perfect hair, perfect body, perfect eyes. Beth feels her strong desire to be with this man. Her emotional self has energized her sexual self. Aroused, she is now on the prowl. Without even knowing it, Beth draws the lover energy from the collective conscious and becomes a goddess. Her skin becomes radiant, her smile sensual, her lips soften. She casually saunters over to the handsome man. When she speaks to him, she immediately envelops him in her goddess lover energy. He is now a god. He says and does exactly the right things. He is sensitive, loving, protective, and has gentle strength. They are glued together. They talk all night. A perfect couple goes home together. What a perfect party. What a perfect night. 1 year later, on a rainy evening, Beth is sobbing. Okay. 1 year later.
Yeah, you can start now.
On a rainy evening.
Start over.
1 year later, on a rainy evening, Beth is sobbing uncontrollably as she lay in her bed, waiting for him to come home. He never came home that night. He was in the arms of another woman. Beth felt betrayed. She felt horribly used and painfully rejected. She threw him out of her life. But the damage to her heart was severe. "I'll never let another man hurt me like that," she vowed, as she unconsciously placed psychic shields around her heart. She thought of her father and the trauma she experienced when at age 10 her father left her mother for another woman. She never saw him again. "You can't trust any man," she cried into her pillow. "You can't trust love." Was Beth really betrayed? Or did Beth's emotional self ambush her sexual self and take complete control of all other aspects of self? Beth's emotional self wanted what it wanted when it wanted it. Beth's desire overpowered everything. She became a goddess to get what she wanted. The handsome man had little to do with the whole thing. He was simply caught in Beth's web. If Beth could have sustained the goddess energy, the handsome man might have stayed in her web. But Beth is not a goddess. Her emotional self hijacked the energy to get what she wanted. The emotional self cannot sustain that intensity of desire. Eventually, the energy peters out, and the real person returns with all his or her grumpiness, personal habits, silliness, and aggravating coping mechanisms. So in Beth's case, all her quirks and bad habits came roaring back. All her partner's quirks and bad habits returned. Neither are perfect. The energy in the relationship dwindled. Her partner became unfaithful. Beth blamed her partner, her father, God, and most of all herself for being stupid enough to get involved. Beth was not stupid. She allowed herself to be controlled by her emotional self to get what she desired. She was deaf and blind to all else. Beth was unaware of her inner selves and their imbalance and dysfunction. If Beth had been more aware of herself and all their components, the evening at the party might have unfolded like this. Beth arrives at the party feeling good about herself and her life. She gets a drink and begins to mumble with a guest. Out of the corner of her eye, she notices a very handsome man. She thinks about approaching him, but notices that he puts his hand on the derriere of a pretty woman as she passed by him. The handsome man looks up. Their eyes meet. Beth can see that he is not ready for a meaningful relationship. He is only interested in having a good time without commitment. He was in a phase of needing to prove his worth to himself, and his behavior and energy reflected how it was still experimenting to find that self-esteem. In this second scenario, Beth did not judge this man to be good or bad. She recognized from her clear observation where he was in his self-awareness and growth. Beth could admire and appreciate his handsomeness from afar, or perhaps have a wonderful evening with him without the fantasy of a lifelong relationship. So Beth's partner did not betray her. At that time in his life, he was incapable of love and being faithful to one woman. Beth's desire blinded her objectivity. While the emotional self can be a troublemaker when it is aware and behaves in healthy ways, the emotional self becomes a powerful force of healing and creativity. Beth's story is typical and a great example of how, with the help of the emotional self, the sexual self can be overtaken. The emotional self's desire overpowers the presence, creating a physical desire for sex. When the emotional self comprises the sexual self to capture the attention and love of another, it always leads to trouble. Sexual desire is often misinterpreted as love. This weak foundation rarely, if ever, sustains a long-term loving relationship. As it falls apart, partners in the relationship feel guilty, unworthy, and empty. When led by an unhealthy emotional self, we tend to lose our higher faculty of wisdom. With a healthy emotional self, it is possible to make choices with greater clarity, to love ourselves, and even to have loving feelings for others without getting involved in sexual encounters with individuals about which we know very little. If we shut off our emotions and our feelings, we're sacrificing a great aspect of ourselves. Shutting down is not the answer. Wounded inner child. An unhealthy emotional self invariably has a wounded inner child lying deep in caverns of hurt and misbelief. When the inner child is healthy, mature, and understands that it has not been abandoned, the emotional self becomes a positive and powerful force. It becomes the healer of the physical body. It gives one the desire and vitality to get up in the morning, to participate in the day, to be involved with one's partner. If the inner child is emotionally wounded, we become afraid of our emotions and feelings. We have no desire to be in touch with our feelings because our feelings about ourselves and our life are unpleasurable. When we shut down our emotions, we begin to dry up. We lose our vitality. Everything becomes duty. Everything becomes routine. We love that sense of awe, that spark, that juice that makes us feel vitally alive. Given our instinctual need to feel and be with others, and for our own emotional health, we must be able to make safe connections with other people. We must have juice going back and forth with others. We must dare to care again. How does the inner child reach the point of shutting down? Imagine this scenario. Mary, a 10-year-old child, sits on the back steps of her home, looking sullen and staring into space. She has just had a horrendous fight with her brother. She sits alone, feels alone. At this moment, she has severed emotional ties with her brother and with her mother for supporting her brother in the argument with her father, for being married to her mother, and with her friends for never being there when she needed them. Mary is experiencing a total state of isolation. If you could read this young girl's thoughts, you would hear words like these repeating themselves, like a tape recorder in a never-ending loop. No one understands me and no one cares. Mary's perception at that moment is truth to her. No one cares, no one understands. I am alone. These embedded thoughts alter her perception of self and her world. She believes she is isolated. This part of her never really participates in life. She becomes disconnected from life itself. Will Mary ever recover? We know that Mary will eventually get off the back steps, go inside her home, play with her brother and her friends, and kiss her mother and father goodnight. Yes, even though she participates in these routine events in her life, she now has a new facade. Her presence enables her to go through the motions, and the emotional self shields and protects that wounded little girl. Behind this facade, those negative thoughts still vibrate, while Mary silently and unconsciously resolves that no one will ever hurt her again. Others do not matter, and she can play the game of life. Mary's story continues. Mary's mind and body matures. She leaves home. She gets a job, marries, and has children of her own now. Her daily life is hectic. Responsibility as an employee, wife, and mother consume all her time. There's not a moment to think of herself. Mary is constantly doing for her family, her work, and others. She falls into bed at night, tired, and already thinking of tomorrow's tasks and duties. Mary's husband is a good man. He's supportive, thoughtful, and a good provider. As time goes by, her children grow up and have left home. All outward appearances indicate a happy and fulfilled life. Yet at 1 o'clock in the morning, when all is quiet, tears slowly fall down her face. Mary feels terribly alone. Even with her husband sleeping soundly beside her, she feels isolated, apart from everything and everyone. What is happening to Mary? With grown children, Mary's duties as a mother have shifted and no longer require so much of her time, leaving her feeling restless and empty. Her job has ceased to be stimulating, and every day is just another repetitious, dull routine. Mary is tired and feeling old. Life no longer holds anything of interest to her. The tears continue to trickle down her cheeks. Deep within her, that wounded child, who was locked away for decades, hidden from harm's way, is sobbing violently. No longer distracted by responsibilities and duties, Mary's facade of all protection weakens. Her inner child, the young girl who believed she was different, misunderstood, and alone, has stepped out of her internal hiding place. And as a result, Mary feels her sadness, unhappiness, and aloneness. In these moments, when the repressed thoughts of the inner child surface, one cannot help but feel the emotions, even though one is not consciously aware of its source. Mary, where was it? In Mary's cases. In Mary's case, she gets up from a night of tears, goes to work depressed, deeply aware of her isolation. Mary's story continues. Days pass, weeks pass. Her husband finally notices that something is wrong. He suggests that she go to the doctor to get something, some medication for her depression. Mary resists every suggestion that her family or friends offer, all the while thinking, they do not understand. I am alone. Of course, these thoughts take her into deeper feelings of isolation, while a silent rage begins to form. Anger, hostility, and resentful feelings. Mary's inner child is now angry at everyone, at life, at God, at all humanity, for never being there for her. In between the bursts of anger, Mary becomes sad. Sadness that she is unable to talk about with anyone. Mary just knows that no one cares. No one understands. How could she, and why should she talk to anyone? 2 years later, her marriage is near divorce. Her children are busy with their lives, and she has left her job for health reasons. Embarrassing bladder problems. Mary gains 20 pounds. Soon she begins having nagging lower back pain. She rarely feels good and seldom has the energy to move through her day. Mary is 48 years old, but feels like a 70-year-old. Sitting in her kitchen one morning, Mary realized that she did not have the energy to go through the day. Her heart was not in it. She saw no joy and had no interest. Yet suicide was not an option for her. Mary was facing the longest day of her life. Her husband was working late. She languished in this feeling of despair and aloneness. By early evening, Mary not only gave up hope for something better, but she also gave up faith that her life would ever be meaningful. Those dark, gloomy thoughts from her inner child consumed her. Mary could no longer feel love, even the love of her family. She turned inward, giving in completely to her inner child's harsh thoughts. It was at that moment her spirit, the spark of light and love within her heart, the source of her life force, began to separate from her body to seek another form that would express its purpose. 2 months later, she was diagnosed with cancer and was told she was terminally ill. 6 months later, she died at the age of 50. At Mary's funeral, her family and friends cried as they remembered her as a good person, someone who always did for others. What happened to Mary? She never knew that the perception of life she developed when she was 10 years old would affect her later life. Mary never became aware of the source of her profound sadness, isolation, and anger. The facade of protection she created worked for a while, but not forever. She succumbed to the emotional wounds of her childhood without ever being aware that her issues were coming from deep within her. Our inner child is a precious, life-giving, awe-inspiring part of us that, when allowed to mature and express, provides for our eternal youth, supplies the vitality and spontaneity needed to live healthy and happy lives. It requires love and emotional nourishment to thrive. Yet many people grow up in dysfunctional families, and many of us carry the deeply repressed thoughts and faulty perceptions of a wounded inner child. For a time, we can muffle the feelings of isolation, sadness, abandonment, disappointment, or distrust. But eventually, those perceptions will surface and create problems. Know that this inner child can be rescued and healed. A healthy inner child within our emotional self can be a healing force, providing exuberant energy to live an inspired and creative life. As will all ourselves, our emotional self and inner child are worthy of our love. The Achiever. Your reason and your passion are the rudder and the sails of your seafaring soul. If either your sails or your rudder be broken, you can but toss and drift, or else be held at a standstill in mid-seas. For reason ruling alone is a force confining and passion unattended. It is a flame that burns in its own destruction. Therefore, let your soul exalt your reason to the heights of passion, that it may sing, and let it direct your passion with reason, that your passion may have through its own daily resurrection, and like the phoenix rise above its own ashes. Tahil Gibran, Lebanese-American writer, poet, and visual artist, 1883 to 1931. We live in an achievement-oriented world. We judge and are judged many times by what we possess or what we have accomplished. We have become a society that believes individuals are what they do. If we do not achieve, we are nothing. Many people believe and live as if their thinking mind is everything. However, the achiever, our mental body, our ability to reason and analyze, is only 1/7 of our vital functions. We are not what we do. We are who we are. The achiever is simply that part of us that does. Located just above the belly button, The achiever is an extraordinarily strong self. When the achiever is immature, disconnected, and unaware of the other aspects of self, it takes on an air of self-importance. The thoughts and feelings housed within the self become haughty, manipulative, and controlling. Our accomplishments become all-important and of more value than our connection with people, especially our loving relationships. The achiever, in its zealous quest for recognition and acknowledgement, moves further away from other selves. Like the loving self who could keep it in check, alone the achiever can be relentless and ruthless. It can all too easily follow the Machiavellian philosophy, the end justifies the means. At its worst, immature and without balance from the loving self, the achiever will seek to overpower and control, even at the sacrifice of all other selves. Happiness, peace of mind, love, and health mean very little in comparison to achievement. But on the other hand, when the achiever is aware, it respects and values the functions and abilities of our other six selves. The aware achiever accomplishes more with less effort. Liken it to a successful and winning sports team. A team that respects and values its memories, knows how to utilize the strengths of each of its members. They are in alignment. Each member steps up at the exact best moment to move the team forward. Together, they achieve. Together, they win. Every member is rewarded. Each is recognized. They are a well-functioning team. Sadly, not all teams are aligned, especially with the lower three selves. When disharmony or disrespect occurs, the scores suffer. When the achiever seeks control or dominance, it loses awareness of its team. The other selves, or creates a war among the selves, causing tremendous frustration and internal conflict. Here is a good example. In her 30s, Barbara was diagnosed with diabetes. She was instructed to take medication and change her diet to keep her blood sugar levels within healthy ranges. The doctor was very candid with her when he warned her that if she did not change her diet, she would soon be on insulin. He also told Barbara of the dire consequences of diabetes left untreated: blindness, loss of limbs, and early death. She panicked. She made resolutions to change her diet immediately. Barbara had a high level of stress in many areas of her life. Her achiever was in high gear. Running her own printing business, she worked long hours, often under pressure of meeting tight deadlines. In addition, Barbara had three teenage children, two daughters and a son. A single parent without any support, coping with all the daily tasks that required her attention, she would grab lunch at a fast food restaurant and snack throughout the day. Dinner depended on what the children's extracurricular activities were that evening. They were not planned, routine meals except on Sunday. Barbara loved to bake, so when she had time on Sundays, she often made pies and cakes, which were usually eaten by Sunday night. So when Barbara learned she had diabetes, her achiever made the resolution to change her eating habits. The reasons are good. She has three children to raise by herself. She made a plan, a plan she resolved to stick to no matter what. Well, by the end of the first week, she had not followed her plan at all. Her emotional self did not allow it. She just had to have that brownie snack. She could not make cakes and pies without eating them. Her emotional self far more than it had ever eaten, just to show her who was boss. She would die without the brownie, and she will die with them. Barbara's achiever made resolutions. It had a plan. But the achiever and the emotional self were not functioning as a team. So to continue the sports analogy, the emotional self kept slipping the ball past the goalkeeper, so to speak. The emotional self wins, the achiever loses, while the presence becomes more confused, feels more out of control, and helpless, like a true victim. Victim of who or what? Victim of self. Wait a minute. Barbara's selves are supposed to be on the same team. What happened? Unless the selves are working together, the mission will never be accomplished. The emotional self will always ignore the achiever. As we noted earlier in this chapter, the unhealthy emotional self has the intensity, vitality, and power to get what it wants, even if what it wants is unhealthy for the entire energy system. Unfortunately, because of society pressure to achieve, most of us have attached our self-worth to achievement and must achieve to feel any sense of worth. To do this, we allow our achiever to dominate, caging our emotional self in our dungeon of repressed thoughts and throwing away the key. The achiever becomes convinced that it cannot trust the emotional self, counting all the times that the emotional self caused problems. The achiever strengthens its determination by fueling the misguided thought, every time I feel, I get hurt. Individuals whose achiever dominates have given up their ability to feel, to maintain control, to prevent problems. In these cases, the emotional self is not dead. It waits and watches for the opportunity to seek revenge. When the achiever is in charge, life is work, work, work. The achiever would rather be doing than feeling. It feels its self-worth only through doing. Sadly, it is possible to work yourself to death. Our achiever, our mental body, I'm going to stop. Can drive us to a state of physical illness.
And hold, we'll have you start with the word our achiever.
Our achiever, our mental body, can drive us to a state of physical illness. The presence cannot keep up the same pace as the achiever. Eventually, the presence's etheric body breaks down, causing our physical body to break down. We get sick. And unfortunately, most people are unaware of their higher selves. So when they get sick, not realizing there are alternatives, they drop into the energy of the emotional self. That emotional self, that inner child, has been locked in a cage with no opportunity to play or even be heard. It has spent its time being angry or feeling sorry for itself. It's been suffering. And now its sweet revenge is becoming the victim, complaining about everything and everyone. No one calls me when I'm sick. I care about other people. Why can't they be thoughtful? Whine, whine, whine. Everything is wrong, and there is nothing wrong with just about everyone. I said something.
Okay, well, let's start again.
Okay. No one calls me when I'm sick. I care about others. Why can't they be thoughtful? Whine, whine, whine. Everything is wrong, and there is something wrong with just about everyone. We are miserable, believing that there are no good feelings anywhere. We fuel the thought, I'm not going to care about anyone anymore. Poor me. Despite the misery, the individuals with strong achievers force themselves to get well. They put their nagging, whining, angry emotional self back in the cage and let the achiever dominate again, losing themselves in doing to avoid feeling. Burnout and illness. As you have discerned by now, the achiever is not a feeling aspect of self. Its purpose is to reason and accomplish. Our achievement is our testimony to worth, to ourself, and to the outside world. We start to feel better about ourselves. Through behavioral conditioning, we find this is a safe dimension of self. We value ourselves more highly when we are worth something. When we are always doing, we leave little time for anything else. There is no time for relaxation, for the personal needs. There's no time for family outside the context of doing. We do at work and come home only to continue doing. This is a destructive spiral. The body burns out. Tired, we lose our patience with others. We become hard-hearted. Caring takes time away from doing. Being loving and sensitive only gets in the way of getting things done. We have every excuse in the world to justify our hard-heartedness. We are deeply embedded in the misbelief that actions do not hurt us. People hurt us. Therefore, doing of self and only produced from our mental body are achiever. But eventually the achiever becomes dissatisfied. At some point, we get very, very tired. Everything becomes an effort. We feel as if we are pushing our way through life, forcing ourselves to get things accomplished. When we let our guard down for an instant, the negative weight we are carrying squeezes through the bars of our cage. We feel depressed, stuck, and burned out. What we once loved and enjoyed is no longer fulfilling. The vitality of our inner child, our emotional self, is diminished, leaving only aggravation, anger, and dissatisfaction. So now, both the achiever and the emotional self are unhappy. When this happens, the presence does not know what to do. It's too tired and has little of the physical energy it once had. The achiever and emotional self are using up all its energy. At this point, the presence feels trapped. Thoughts begin to swirl. I cannot get another job. I'm too old. I have no other skills. What if I become financially strapped? Oh, I cannot change jobs. In all this confusion, the presence cannot see a solution, way out of its situation. When the presence feels trapped and confused, the achiever, in its efforts to feel better, does what it does best. It isolates. The achiever takes its stalwart stance, saying to itself, I must do everything myself if I want it done right. Achiever is in this space, we become righteous. We perceive everything as either right or wrong, according to our own values. Being right becomes more important than making it work, even with our loved ones. And in this space, our sexual self and our loving relationships suffer. We forget that we once fell in love with our spouse just the way they are. Now we attempt to create them in our own image, according to who we think they should be and what we think they should be doing. We become their unsolicited teachers, coaches, managers, and manipulators. We are no longer a loving spouse, friend, and supporter. We become the enemy, watching for weakness and mistakes, and take pride in our ability to analyze what is wrong with them. We view our children as our possessions. We strive to create them in our image according to the gospel of our achiever. They must accomplish what we think is right for them, giving no credence to their strengths, talents, character, or desires. This approach with our children creates disharmony and wounds that child's emotional self. This perpetuating cycle of dysfunctional and poor emotional health, according to the Center for Disease Control, using data from 1999 through 2006, suicides were 11% of all deaths among teenagers. Parenting solely from the achiever has little, if any, benefit. If the achiever exclusively directs your life and the lives of others, it is time to reevaluate. Our presence, emotional self, and achiever are essential parts of our key seven selves. And as you can see, they interact closely with each other. If the emotional self and achiever are dysfunctional, it is only a matter of time before the presence, too, becomes unhealthy. Negative thoughts and negativity in general prevail. In that energy, we perceive everything we experience as being negative. Yes, our achiever is an expert at accomplishments. However, its purpose does not lie solely in achievements and the acquisition of material trophies. Our achiever can move mountains when inspired by the next higher dimension of self. The loving self. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love, I am becoming a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could move mountains, and have not love, I have nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long, and it is kind. Love doesn't praise itself. It is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemingly, seeketh not its own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. It beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, and endureth all things. Love never fails. 1 Corinthians 13, 1-6. The Bible, that's why I was having trouble. Midway among ourselves, the loving self is a key influence for all the other selves. The awakened loving self is the conductor in this symphony of selves. In an emotionally healthy individual, the lower selves work in cooperation with the loving self, and the higher selves become instruments of the heart. So what is this loving self? The loving self is located at the sternum, in the general area of the heart. Like other selves, the loving self can become unhealthy, dysfunctional, filled with faulty thoughts concerning love. Common faulty thoughts in this self include, you cannot trust love, and everyone you love leaves you. You might think that these thoughts would be stored within the emotional self. However, throughout our life, often repeated failed relationships, we can begin to blame love rather than our overzealous desire to get what we wanted. Most people love from their emotional self. This is conditional love. For example, some parents love their children with the unspoken thought, I love you as long as you are a good reflection of me. Or, if I cannot handle what you do and who you are, I do not want to be involved with you because I cannot handle the pain you have caused me. Similarly, spouses who only have conditional love for their partners may think and feel, I love you only if you are mine. If you leave me for any reason, I hate you. I hope you burn in hell. Emotional love can be possessive, jealous, manipulative, and vengeful if it does not get its way. Our emotional self wants its way all the time, and its capacity to love is always conditional. Conditional love usually stems from deeply rooted thoughts and feelings of hurt and pain. The loving self is that part of us who cares, who has compassion for others, who recognizes and acknowledges and values that we each have our unique characteristics. The loving self is the source of unconditional love. But remember, it is unconditional love that enables us to set boundaries, to understand what is acceptable for a safe and healthy relationship, and to find the strength to say no when necessary. The loving self, like its counterparts, can become unhealthy. At these times, we can develop heartquakes and heart dungeons. Heartquakes. The sadness and pain we feel in our heart comes from some of the thoughts and feelings that are lying on the surface of our loving self. Our feelings of futility, and thoughts of hopelessness cause what I like to call heartquakes. A heartquake shakes away our positive thoughts, leaving thoughts of harsh self-judgment and little worth. For the most part, these thoughts are deeply repressed, and while we might be unaware of them, we are still very much affected by them. With heartquakes, we exaggerate our shortcomings and perceive every tiny mistake take as an unforgivable deed. Those who feel they are no damn good are in a heartquake. Those who are afraid to let another person get close are in a heartquake. In these situations, our heart is not dead. Our heart is not the dark clouds of thoughts that hover over us. Our heart cannot be extinguished by our thoughts. Love is our true nature. The depth of love is who we really are. The loving self waits to be recovered and set free. The loving self always waits, no matter how long it takes for us to acknowledge it. The loving self waits to be freed to create love and abundance in our life. In Jean Houston's book, The Search for the Beloved, she speaks about the sacred wound. Sacred psychology is the process and practice of soul making. And in soul making, as you may have discovered, is not necessarily a happy thing. Critical parts of it are not. As seed making begins with the wounding of the ovum by the sperm, so does soul making begin with the wounding of the psyche by the larger story. Soul making requires that you die to one story to be reborn to a larger one. Renaissance happens because the soul is breached. In this wounding, the psyche is opened and a new questions begin to be asked about who we withdraw, but can lead to the seeding of the world with the newly released powers of the psyche. A larger story is revealed by the wounding. When psychological energy is no longer bonded to us, then uncensored depths, images, and archetypes can have their day. Whether they serve to madden or illumine are in our depths. Their powerful questions need not lead to alienation, and is up to us. The classical Renaissance was a golden time when internal and external realities flowed together. The internal world knew the cosmos for its own, and the external world became psychized. The spillover of psyche's abundance into the outer world primed the creation of vital and resonance arts, sciences, history, statescraft, and philosophy. So too is your wounding, the breaching of your soul, an invitation to your renaissance. Our wounding tells us that old forms are ready to die. However reluctant the local self may be to allow this to occur, and that hitherto unsuspected new forms are ready to flower. As the ties that bind loosen in our culture and in our psyche, the incidence of wounding accelerates and comes in many guises. Consider your physical wounding, illness, accidents, birth, or genetic effects. Consider the acts of violation upon your person, rape, incest, child abuse, torture, robbery. Consider the losses you have endured, the loss of deep relationship, the loss of a job, the loss of a marriage, the loss of sanity, the loss of self-esteem, the loss of status, the loss of financial security. Consider those soundings that have afflicted cultures and nations, famine, plagues, enslavement, war. The list seems endless. Wounding involves a painful excursion into pathos, wherein the anguish is enormous and the suffering crude. The boundaries of what you thought you could bear. And yet the wounding pathos of your own local story may contain the seeds of healing and transformation. The recognition of this truth is not new. In the Greek tragedies, the gods forced themselves into human consciousness at the time of pathos. It is only at this time of wounding that the protagonists grow into a larger sense of what life is all about and can act accordingly. The wounding becomes sacred when we are willing to release our old stories and to become the vehicles through which the new story may emerge into time. When we fail to do this, we tend to repeat the same old story repeatedly. If you have a neurosis or psychosis, it probably originated in pathos that was not to its source in a larger story. If we only look for far enough, we would find that our wounding has archetypal power. In uncovering their mythic base, we are challenged to a deeper life. As Carl Jung has reminded us, it makes a difference whether we serve a mania, which is detestable and undignified, or a god, which is full of meaning. I don't know how to pronounce it. Sandra Catalucci wrote an article published in the Delphi University's Healing Arts Journal, 1977, a true story that so eloquently describes the effects of heartquakes. She wrote, David was a Navajo Indian born on the reservation. By the time he was 14, he was an alcoholic. At 15, he and a friend of his, another Navajo, ran away from the reservation and joined the Merchant Marines. They met up with another runaway, a German boy, and they all became fast friends and shipped all over the world together. David was an artist, and as they traveled, he would sketch the things he saw. What he did not know was that the things he saw and were sketching were Japanese bunkers, which were being prepared prior to the beginning of World War II. He submitted his sketches to the American military and later enlisted in the military service. He thought he would continue to be an artist for the military, but the military instead made him a decoder. Navajo was the one language that the Germans did not know. They did not have any Navajo in Germany. They thought it was a code and could not break it. It used symbols in different
intonations.
They thought it was a code. This is a fascinating story. They thought it was a code and could not break it. They thought it was a code and could not break it. It used symbols and different intonations at different times. It became the unbreakable code during the war. David was dropped behind enemy lines to do his job as a decoder. Later, he was captured by the Germans and was tortured unmercifully. They nailed his feet to the floor and made him stand there for 3 days. He was beaten repeatedly and much more. The Germans then determined that he was not worthy to keep alive. He was a third-class citizen anyway, just an Indian. So they sent him off to Auschwitz, to the death camp. He was being shuffled off to the cattle car. And there was a German soldier with a rifle jammed into his back, shouting at him. Well, the soldier friend pulled him out of the crowd and made other arrangements for him to be sent to another camp. At this camp, David was by then so ill and broken that all he could do was lie on a bunk in a stupor. Every day, one German guard would come in and push maggots into his mouth, or chicken gizzards, and David was too weak to stop them. Well, the war dragged on, and then finally ended. When the Americans came to liberate the camp and questioned David, he replied in Russian, perfect Russian. He somehow was channeling Russian and had no memory of American language. He was released to the Russians, who rejected him as not their own. They sent him back to the Americans, and he ended up at last somewhere at a veterans hospital in Battle Creek, Michigan, USA. He lapsed into a coma for 2 years. After he awakened, he could not walk. He was a cripple and used braces on his legs and crutches to drag himself around. He determined at that time to return to his tribe, made peace with them, and then returned to the Veterans Hospital to live out the time that was left to him before he died. So he went home, and when the tribal elders saw and talked to him, they called a council meeting to discuss how they could help him. They took David, tied a rope around his waist, threw him into deep water, and told him, "Call back your spirit, David. You have no spirit. Your spirit is still in Germany. Call it back." Well, David said calling his spirit was harder to do than standing for 3 days with his feet nailed to the floor. To call back his spirit, he had to go through every trauma he had lived through in the war. He saw the faces of all of the tormentors, and he had to release them and forgive them and let them go. And when the face of the guard that had come every day and fed him maggots and chicken gizzards appeared before him, he said, "Okay, I don't know why you did it, but I release you. I forgive you." And as soon as David did this, the face of the guard turned to him and said, "I did it to keep you alive, David. It was the only food I could find." And then it disappeared. By releasing and forgiving the guard, David was able to open to the bigger purpose, and he had not even been able to see before. David's spirit returned. He taught himself to walk again and went on to become a shaman, a medicine man, and was an instrumental force in his tribe's life. Beautiful story, isn't it? Note, many years later in December, he called a friend of his, an editor, and said, "Hi, Carolyn, how are you doing?" Carolyn replied, "Fine, David, what are you doing here in this city?" David said, "Oh, nothing, just passing through. I just wanted to ask you if you would publish my biography for me." She thought it strange that he said biography, but not everyone was as fussy as editors about the proper terminology. So she said, "Sure, David, I'd love to publish your biography." David thanked her and ended the conversation, and she did not think any more about it. In December, another friend called her and asked if she knew that David Paladin had died on December 18th. David had called her from the beyond to ask a favor of her, but nothing happened for several years. Then one day, an editor friend of hers called her and said, "Carolyn, I'm editing a collection of stories about people, and I wondered if you would edit the story about David Paladin, since you knew him personally." And she performed the favor asked by David Chet LaHaye Paladin so long before. Heart dungeons. In addition to heartquakes, there are heart dungeons. Heart dungeons are formed by self-hatred, those ugly beliefs that we are evil. It is the place where we are forever judging our past wrong deeds and abuse of power. These are the thoughts that form the ugly scenes, the frightening feelings, and the fear that convinces us that we are heartless and do not deserve the good things in life. These negative thoughts of self form the dungeons designed to trap our so-called demons that we fear are within us. When we harbor these types of thoughts, we feel we are living a lie. We feel phony. We create facades to feel people. But we can never let anyone close for fear they find out how despicable we are. We have externally damned ourselves because of our wrongdoings. We have determined that we do not deserve happiness, abundance, or even good luck. Like a recurring tape, we repeatedly tell us that feeling good will always be followed by feeling bad. That tape eternally assures us that if anyone ever knew the real us, they would not like us. On and on every day, every hour, every minute, that tape creates a hell within us of our own making. Hells that our thoughts create, not our wrongdoings. Most of the time, our thoughts of self are far worse than anything we have ever done. We hold ourselves back from positions of leadership because we do not trust ourselves. We are afraid of our own power. We are afraid we will abuse it. We feel unworthy, as if something deep inside us tells us we're undeserving. While sometimes those fears of self are conscious, and more times than not, they are unconscious, occasionally leaking into our lives like a poisonous gas, crippling us just when something important or wonderful is about to happen. Of course, we think these horrible thoughts must be true, or else why would we have them? It never occurs to us that these negative thoughts and feelings are the result of soft self-condemnation and our own lack of awareness and ability to forgive ourselves. Our loving self has the power to break down these walls of the heart dungeon, to remove the armor created by heartbreaks, to send the so-called demons to the light. The loving self has the capacity to forgive ourselves and others for any injuries. We can resurrect our heart, restore our loving self to its full nature, and start again. Our loving self is the primal force of all good and abundance. The healthy loving self. Forgiveness is the key to a healthy loving self. Forgiving all known and unknown errors in judgment, mistakes, and wrongdoings, perceived or real. To forgive others, one must first forgive oneself. To love and value others, one must first love and value oneself. Although heartquakes and dungeons squelch all loving feelings toward self, you can move the debris aside. You can become aware of some of the treasures of your heart. Then begin to heal those things that created the heartquakes and dungeons. Experiencing the power of your loving self gives you the strength, will, and courage to forgive self for your unawareness and release the debris that was covering the expression of your love. You can begin to create a loving and fulfilling life. Heart songs. Have you heard the phrase, song in your heart? When you feel an intense, euphoric feeling of joy and contentment, you are feeling that song in your heart. It is the healthy, loving self's way of rejoicing in life. B.J. Skerritt, in an article published in the March 1997 issue of Popular Science magazine, wrote, "A song in your heart may do more than boost your spirits. It may also signal a healthy ticker. While it may feel like your heart has the steady beat of a ticking metronome, there is a lot of variation in the time between one heartbeat and the next. At first glance, the intervals appear to be random, but in Harvard Medical School cardiologist Dr. Amy Goldberger, there is some order in the randomness that tells an important story. Healthy hearts, it turns out, have more beat-to-beat variability than ailing hearts. They also have an inherent song. After making hours-long heartbeat recordings of volunteers' hearts, Goldberger and his assistants averaged the intervals of every 300 beats to smooth out changes caused by moving or breathing, and mapped the resulting whole numbers to notes on the diatonic scale. What the researchers expected was random noise. What they got instead was often quite musical, with the recordings from healthy hearts yielding more interesting melodies than those from disease-damaged hearts. Goldberger's son, pianist and composer Zach David, added rhythm and harmonies to these natural melodies and recorded them for a CD called Heart Songs. The songs sound much like a jazz or new age composer noodling around on a keyboard, playing from the heart, as it were. Love with wisdom. Seeing the world through the eyes of the loving self can seem mystical at times. Space and even time seem to dissolve. In this mystical place, one can see beyond the physical appearance of someone, see beyond that momentary state of condition of someone, to see deep within them. In these moments, you can see the potential of that person's heart. You can see that we are all the same. It is impossible to hate when you can see these depths in another person. Your loving self forms a bond of friendship with all other selves. Cooperative spirit, a harmonious cooperation. In this energy, you cannot help but express your love with wisdom. You have resurrected your heart and released the negative weight you have been carrying. It will become second nature to share your love, abilities, and wisdom with all those that are attracted to you. The rest of the world is free without judgment to grow or stagnate, to live or to die, to find their heart or continue to carry their negative weight. Love and wisdom combine to empower your life. Life changes. Values and tastes change. Friends change. Relationships are healed or ended. Transition is a part of your life because of the many changes. Things are not like they used to be. Creative expressor. Believe in yourself. Have faith in your abilities. Without a humble but reasonable confidence in your own powers, you cannot be successful or happy. Formulate and stamp indelibly on your mind a mental picture of yourself as succeeding. Hold this picture tenaciously. Never permit it to fade. Your mind will seek to develop the picture. Do not build up obstacles in your imagination. Do not be awestruck by other people and try to copy them. Nobody can be you as effectively as you can be. Norman Vincent Peale, American minister and author, 1898 to 1993. Located in the throat, your creative expressor is first among the three higher selves. It encompasses all our thoughts and feelings relating to expressing our abilities in the world. Whether those abilities are expressed through the spoken word, writing, art, or other ways. Mature adults jokingly asked, "What am I going to be when I grow up?" Well, this self is cleared of self-doubts and fears. The thoughts, feelings, and abilities of our true expressor unite with our other selves to be full expression of our qualities, talents, and contributions to life. Sadly, many people have intentionally closed off their expressor, allowing strong fears and doubts to overtake their own expression. On the other end of the spectrum, there are many people who misuse their expression loudly and frequently. In these cases, people do not hold back, especially when they are expressing from anger. Venting one's anger and using one's expression as a weapon is not the true purpose of the creative expressor. It is possible for the unawakened expressor to become a tool for the emotional self and achiever to use or misuse as they will for their own and often hurtful objectives. Here is an interesting example. John was a vice president of a Fortune 500 corporation. He found it very difficult to speak in business meetings, especially in meetings attended by those who held high positions in their respective companies. Since his job required that he attend and speak at the board of director meetings of several corporations, his fear and discomfort in their settings were creating issues. John was known in these meetings as the silent member because he just could not make himself speak up when necessary. While he had no problem expressing himself in personal relationships or with the staff, he managed important business situations, like board of director meetings, left him tongue-tied, afraid he would put his foot in his mouth. John came to me for help. During our sessions, as we began to discover the repressed thoughts and feelings of his creative expressor, one image consistently emerged: the devil holding a pitchfork. As we went further, John discovered that he saw his creative expressor as an evil force, one that could injure others. He did not trust his creative expressor, therefore he would not express. He froze in meetings because he did not trust his ability to express without being hurtful. When did this image and thought begin to originate? In John's case, it was in a past life. He remembered a situation where he was a Roman orator and soldier. In this life, he was an eloquent, passionate, even fiery speaker, able to arouse and motivate crowds. He had the ability to incite riots with his words. Before leading a group of soldiers into battle, John realized them with a passionate speech that emboldened them and stirred their anger for the enemy. The entire group of soldiers were killed in battle. John was the only supervisor and survivor. Deeply remorseful, he exiled himself and spent the remainder of his life in silence, vowing never again to use his words to hurt another. John realized immediate changes. He now understood why he did not trust his ability to express. At the next board meeting, he gave an eloquent presentation on the marketing of a new product. This is a true story, by the way. This is Marshall. At the next board meeting, he gave an eloquent presentation on the marketing of a new product. In his audience, this group of directors applauded. With his new awareness, my client had freed his creative expressor. He knew that he would never again misuse his ability to express. The creative expressor is a key part of our wholeness, yet it lies almost dormant until the loving self is resurrected and frees to love. These two selves serve as the directors of all the other aspects of self. Imagine your sexual self taking its direction from this team, knowing just the right heartfelt words to touch the hearts of your partner, feeling and expressing your true loving nature. Wow, talk about sex on Saturday night. If you never met your loving self or creative expressor, you're missing the fullness of richness in your life. If you doubt or distrust your ability to express yourself, or if you use your expression to manipulate others, you have not met your loving self or creative expressor. The teamwork of the loving self and creative expressor, I'm going to start that again. The teamwork of the loving self and creative expressor is a key to a happy sexual self. We must find our own loving expression. It does not matter what we have been taught in the past. We can choose how we use our ability to express. We can begin one step at a time. We can make it through one whole day with loving expression, even if we had to say no to someone. We can feel good about ourselves at the end of the day. We can do it again the next day and the next. Love expressed. When your expressor works closely with the loving self, the tone of your voice begins to change. It becomes melodious and harmonious. The words travel to whomever you are speaking and gently touch them. The tone invites their participation, either through listening or responding. I call this magnetic expression. The tone of love has a charisma all its own. It is not the emotional fervor of an overzealous preacher. It is not the twang of an emotionally upset person. It's not the skilled tone of a professional speaker who pushes the ideas and information at you relentlessly throughout the presentation. It is not the tone of an entertainer who is to please or succeed. The tone of love is a sharing experience. The recipient feels the words and internalizes them. The exchange is reciprocal. After the exchange, the truth of the speaker belongs to the recipient. When your presence encourages your loving self and your creative expressor to represent your soul being, you begin to share the things you love. The loving self is discerning. It only wants to share with those who have a desire to hear. The rest of the world is free to learn and listen to someone else. The law of attraction is the law of love. The tone of love always attracts love. A sensitive person can tell a lot from the tone of someone's voice. We can have facades, phony smiles, and deceptive words, but the tone of our voice never lies. The intuitive self, the visionary. The intuitive self, also called the visionary, is the first of the two higher mystical selves. As such, we move into the area of function and purpose that includes intuition and connection to Source, God. The intuitive self is the source of all our perceptions, both conscious and unconscious. It's located right in the middle of our forehead. The intuitive self lives in a timeless and spaceless zone. It's not limited by the boundaries of our three-dimensional physical world. Every genius, every enlightened being who has ever walked in our world has known his or her visionary. They have seen through their inner eyes to witness what already was and channeled the concept, idea, invention, music, art, or technology into our world. They tap the universal mind, also in our collective unconscious, and channeled what they saw, sensed, or heard into the world of form so it could benefit our world. Their inspiration is our gift. We are great individuals like Einstein and Tesla, intuitive. Both were keenly aware that they were connected to something greater as the source of their inspiration. The intuitive self provides our direction in both our outer physical world and inner intuitive world. When in cooperation with the rest of ourselves, we travel the path with a sense of timelessness. Our movement is steady. Positive changes happen quickly. It is no longer surprising when something good happens. You know this is the way it always should have happened. Now you know why it is happening. The healthy visionary continues to direct us to let go of old negative excess baggage, freeing us to embrace the new. Most of us familiar with the word intuition. When the details of our negative emotions have been removed, we can hear the clear voice of our intuitive self. In this state of awareness, we intuitively understand the course of our lives, where we are going, and our sense of purpose. In this state of awareness, we may not have the details of how, what, and when, or where, because we trust that our lives are unfolding with purpose. We know we are attracting new experiences every moment. We are creating a new life through our ability to attract the positive and loving situations for ourselves. We begin to trust. We realize that we are trusting our intuitive self to guide us in the best direction and to say no when necessary. Some people reading this will roll their eyes and think I am talking about becoming psychic. Oddly enough, the word psychic originated in Greece and means pertaining to the human soul. It refers to human awareness and abilities that go beyond the five physical senses. In modern times, within our unaware society constructs, it has become associated with charlatans or sideshow fun. Everyone is intuitive. Our intuitive self is our telepathic tie with all life. Everyone has an intuitive self, Everyone has a visionary. Everyone can easily learn to trust their own intuition. The intuitive self is often ignored by those on the expressway of life. We rationalize our intuition away. But on the other hand, the unhealthy intuitive self can easily develop into a harsh judging self. To awaken the full nature of our intuitive self and keep that judging self from rising, it is necessary to remove the surface layers of negative self-judgment. As we clear away the negative thoughts and feelings, we discover a new sense of clarity. We begin to see things in our lives with objectivity as they really are. Let me do that sentence again. As we clear away the negative thoughts and feelings, we discover a new sense of clarity. We begin to see things in our lives with objectivity as they really are. It becomes much easier to evaluate our life experiences without emotion. With clarity, we can understand the lessons to be learned from our experiences and make wiser, more creative decisions about our future. Without the discernment sharpened by clarity, we are destined to repeat our mistakes and repeat them often. We already know that an unhealthy emotional self can continually create experiences filled with havoc, confusion, and leave us wondering what's wrong with us. How many failed relationships are necessary to choose a path of self-discovery and healing? Lastly, the healthy intuitive self is the connection to one's memory of Source, God. The unaware presence hears about information of this nature, labels it as God, and decides whether to believe it or discard the information. Whatever your beliefs, through our intuitive self, you have access to all the information that is, was, or ever will be. We have the means to feel just how deeply we are connected to everyone and everything. Few of us, however, venture inward to discover the information, the truth. Even fewer experience the depth and brilliance of their true intuitive self. The angel self. The miracle is not to fly in the air or to walk on the water, but to walk on the earth. Chinese proverb. Our angel self, the seventh and highest frequency self, is located at the top of the head. When we connect with our angel self, we begin to understand everything about our life, all the events and the experiences, all the thoughts and feelings. Everything begins to have meaning, even the difficult experiences. It is easier to understand how each event has carried us one step closer to becoming our higher self. Why we chose to step off the expressway. It shines a light on one's growth as a connected and aware being. The aware angel self being inspired thought, not just rational thought. Our angel thought continually whispers messages of encouragement and inspiration to the rest of ourselves. When we are traveling the expressway of life, we can rarely hear because there is so much noise. Our angel self knowing that at some point in our journey, we will eternally hear, forever persists in sending us messages. Our angel self knows the truth of who we are, sees our potential on earth, and continually reaches out to help us become all that we are. Our angel self understands and guides you toward your purpose. Without a sense of purpose, we can feel so insignificant and small in the grand scheme of life. With a sense of purpose, we become seed sowers of positive thoughts, pioneers of greater ways, and you can realize your purpose at any time, even when doing what some would consider to be mundane things like washing clothes, taking a shower, or mowing the lawn. When the revelations happen, it is a divine event. The angel self has delivered its message right to our heart. I am unique and special. I matter. I have something to give to the world. I am important in the divine scheme of all things. Our angel self knows that love and harmony are possible through the awakening of self. It believes that love and peace is possible on the earth and that it begins within each one of us. The angel self gives inspiration and encouragement to all ourselves. So when the loving self, the angel self, and the presence become one in purpose, love, and action, we walk our talk. We are at peace with ourselves. Have you ever felt your angel self? When you have those persistent thoughts, however fleeting, that you have a purpose, special reason for being on this earth, you're feeling your angel self. The sum of our seven major selves. In summary, each of our seven aspects of self have a function, and each is as equally important of who we are and how we function in the world. Each self has its unique location in our physical body, starting at the sacrum at the base of the spine and progressively moving upward to the top of our head. And each of the seven selves impacts the sexual self. As each self location, there is a nucleus. The energy from the self radiates outward from this nucleus. That energy can be positive or negative depending on the awareness level of the self. This means that each self actively participates in one's emotional and physical health. Aware and healthy selves radiate an aura of well-being and peace from their positive energy. The aware self knows it's part of the whole, never isolated or alone. At these highest function, the healthy selves do this. The angel one inspires our sense of purpose and kinship for life. The intuitive self, the visionary, is our eye of perception and knows the history of our progress as an individual soul. The creative expressor lovingly expresses all our abilities through a variety of ways. The loving self empowers and directs our life with the primal force of love. The achiever provides reason and accomplishment. The emotional self sustains our youth, vitality, sensuality, and enthusiasm. And the present represents all the other selves to the world and owns our sense of self-esteem, confidence, and self-worth. The sum of all ourselves is who we are. We are not just our body or form. We are not just our emotions or mind or heart or we are an accumulation of all these things, even if we are unaware of some of them. Know all the members of your team. Know all your potential, and you will know self. Only then will you have an inner team that works in cooperation for the greater good of you. Only then will you have a healthy sexual self and sex on Saturday night. Deep peace of the running wave to you. Peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you, and deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the gentle nights to you. Deep peace of the Sun of Peace to you. Moon and stars pour their healing light on you. Deep peace to you. Gaelic blessing.